If it's happening now, we're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
All right, lots going on, and we'll try to get to as much of it as we can. And there's an interesting story, and we're going to talk more about this later on. The Toronto School Board Peel in Ottawa say that they are going to sue social media, TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, because of what it's doing to the kids. And then they went on and gave you a long list, and nobody's arguing what overexposure to this does to the kids. I don't think anybody's debating that at all. But is that a reason for these boards to take on this? And then, you know, many are talking about the legal costs, and it's on contingency. So the lawyers that are in charge are getting all kinds of publicity today because they're behind this case, or they will represent. So I don't know, how's that working for the Prime Minister with the news services that we all can't get on social media? How is that strong arm tactic working for the Prime Minister? So I'm not sure what this is going to do. And, you know, it sounds a lot like Florida, where they want to ban social media for those under a certain age. And again, you know, it might be a different situation, but they're both extremes. Just one's on the right and one's on the left. And I understand the intention. And again, I don't disagree with anything that they're talking about, but there is a cell phone ban in Ontario, so it is up to the teacher at their discretion to do something with this. But is this about use in the classroom, or is it just social media in general? And again, you know, noble charge, but the Prime Minister is having no success with this sort of thing. And shouldn't the school board be concentrating on other things? Just saying. And as well, we you know, the Prime Minister yesterday gave us a sneak peek, and we really didn't know what was going on. There's a provincial budget coming up, or sorry, federal budget coming up April 16th, I believe it is. And you know what they're like. They're long and boring, and, you know, reporters go into a lockup, and then they come out, and here's what it is. And it's like this unloaded phone book-sized document in, you know, that gets released in a day. Well, the federal Liberals think that they've got a communication problem, and the problem that they're doing poorly in the polls is not because you don't like them anymore. It's because you're not understanding what they're doing. So they're going to take every day, it would appear, and introduce a new piece of this budget. So by the time the budget comes out 2 weeks from now, a little over 2 weeks from now, you'll already know what it is. And they'll get 16 days or however many days of media attention as they reiterate another chapter of this budget, as opposed to doing it all in one day. So it's a brilliant communications move, but I don't know. You know, yesterday he talked about a rental code of ethics and the Prime Minister and how if you pay your rent, that can be used to your credit score, and he's going to get the banks to use that to, and that doesn't count for credit, but you get like a recommendation letter, I don't know, like from your mom saying that, oh, you know, they paid the rent payment, so now they should qualify for a home. Like, this is just poppycock. And today, another message out in Vancouver this time, but this is on childcare. So he's going to do this for the next 16 days till the budget comes out, and reemphasizing every single portion of the budget all the way through till the budget comes out on April 16th. And so, and it's interesting because as you're listening now, he's framing, you know, his enemy as the conservative premiers. You know, the conservative premiers, as if there's like one or two. There's only one Liberal premier. So, you know, they're all conservative except for BC and Manitoba, which are NDP. There's only one Liberal premier, and he's against the carbon tax hike. So, you know, he keeps talking about the conservative premiers as if it's like maybe his one Liberal guy. I don't know. But it's across the country. And it's fascinating how he moves forward with this. It's going to be neat to see how he carries this through the next 16 days. And if at the end of 16 days, everybody goes, oh, that's what you're trying to do, I get it now. and then completely turn the polls around, or if by about day 4 or 5, they're going to go, you know, this is the same old crap all over again. We're just getting it thrown in our face again as if it's something new. So it's an interesting new strategy, but that's the world of communications that we live in now. And rather than one big budget blowout on the day of, where, you know, the only people that are really happy to hear about it are people like me who you know, delve into it. But other than that, they're going to spread it out over 16 days. All right. We all certainly know the story about Mayor Andrea Horvath, and then also the mayor in Burlington as well, using their strong mayor powers. I don't care, as long as you get the problem solved, what happens here. But what I find fascinating is that both mayors, including Andrea Horvath, spoke out against this, calling it dangerous and all kinds of things until they use it, and then it's okay. And the mayor of Burlington even went to say, well, I didn't ask for it. As if that's some sort of excuse for her using it. So, you know, Tom and I were talking, and it's like, this should be some sort of soap opera. It should be some sort of series, an adventure series, some sort of theme around this whole super mayor's power. Tell us what you think.
The Adventures of Super Mayor. Faster than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound.
Look, up in the sky, it's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's Super Mayor. Yes, it's Super Mayor, strange visitor from another planet who came to Earth with powers and abilities far beyond those of mortal mayors. Super Mayor.
Who can change the course of mighty rivers, bend steel in his bare hands.
As does Andrea Horvath. Mild mannered mayor for the great hammer, the city of Hamilton, fights a never-ending battle for truth, justice, and the Hamilton way.
I think it'll work. I think it's a great idea. Tell us what you think. As you know, a large encampment at Hamilton City Hall has lost its primary organizer. We talked about this on CHML and the news. They left the site after her tent was stolen. This is Angela Voss on Tuesday, after she and others in the tents were given trespass notices and voluntary compliance notices. And again, this actually started as a protest calling for affordable housing in Stony Creek. Remember the fight over the parking lot and the housing? Well, now that situation has been dealt with through the mayor's use of strong mayor's powers, where is the encampment going? What is the status of it? And the people that are living there. Lisa Pileski with us, reporter for 900 CHML. She, of course, has been covering this since day one. Lisa, thanks so much for the time. You're down there now. I know you've been embedded in following the story closely. What do you see now? What is the status of this encampment?
Yeah. Hi, Scott. So the encampment is still here. I think it's maybe about 10 or 15 tents smaller than it was on Monday when I was by. It's still a lot of people here. I mean, like you say, this did start as a protest. Angela came down and basically set up a tent. This was right after the city meeting when councilors shot down the idea for affordable housing in that Stony Creek parking lot. So it initially was going to be a protest until the ratification vote on that. Then we had the cyber attack. So that, you know, that whole vote has pushed it a whole month. So, I mean, this whole thing has kind of lasted a lot longer than I think anyone had planned. And it did start out as a protest, but it is fully an encampment. I mean, these are people who are unhoused living in tents and they have nowhere else to go. So, I mean, whatever it started out as, we know now that it is people who don't have anywhere else to go living in tents. And the city has issued trespass notices and voluntary compliance notices because part of the encampment protocol is that tents cannot be on a heritage site. Apparently, City Hall is a heritage site, so tents are not allowed here. At this point, it's really hard to know where it's going to go now, since the protester, like you say, behind the initial protest here has gone home. And I don't really know what the future is going to be at this point. It's really just kind of a sad situation here. It's just an example of kind of where the housing crisis has led to, not just in Hamilton, but across Canada.
As you said, protest that now has turned into reality and an encampment. Is anybody there talking about leaving, or the fact that this decision has been made now with the mayor and that this housing project is going to go ahead? Does that resonate? Is that an issue? Or again, as you mentioned, is this just people looking for a place? Is there an option, a place for them to go?
Not really, no. And these people, I mean, they are living here because this is where it was safe for them to be. When Angela was here, they were bringing food. They were getting medical care. I believe they still should be getting the medical care. And there are volunteers from Good Shepherd, Registered Nurses Association, are still stopping by to kind of help take care of people. But the fact that the encampment is on a heritage property does pose some concerns, because like I said previously, it's not allowed in the encampment protocol. So unless they make changes to the protocol to allow for tents to be here, it is technically against city bylaws. And I was chatting with someone who's holding some signs down on Main Street here. And she said she was chatting with someone who is facing homelessness in just a couple of days. They're going to be kicked out of their apartment. And when they asked, I guess there were police officers, when they asked them, where do I go? Am I allowed to stay here? They were told, go to Bayfront Park and set up a tent there. So that's the solution that we're looking at right now, I guess. This is what people are being told. That's the latest, what I've heard anyway.
So what is, you talked about the services and what's available, food, what have you, in that site when Angela was still there. Has that dramatically dropped off? You said there's still some of that. How much of those services still available?
I believe those services should still be offered if the volunteer organizations were still stopping by. The problem is right now is when Angela was here, there was kind of a leader, a spokesperson to talk to. Right now, unless you want to go bothering people in the encampment, and I certainly don't, it's hard to know what people are going through. So I was speaking with a volunteer from another local organization yesterday who was trying to help people who were at a loss about what they could do. And it's really just kind of a situation of, well, I mean, if you follow the encampment protocol, you set up tents in those clusters of five and make sure there's certain distances away from certain things, then you'll be left alone. But there's really no solution. This is just, it's a crisis.
And does it look like Bayfront Park is going to become the new home for the encampment or for the people at City Hall anyway?
That I'm not sure, because I mean, it doesn't look like anyone is packing up to move right now. Like I say, there are about 10 or 15 tents fewer than there were a few days ago. So maybe they've gone elsewhere. But I don't know if it's Bayfront Park. I do know that there have been tents there for the past few months, for sure. It could just be another park in the city. We do have a lot of parks where we are seeing encampments prop up because there's nowhere to go. So, and as the summer months come upon us, as it gets warmer out, we're going to be seeing a lot more tents because the weather is more accommodating for people who have nowhere else to go.
Lisa Pileski with us, reporter with 900 CHML, of course, covering the story of the tent encampment at City Hall. And they're now reporting live, and still maybe about a 10 or a dozen tents have gone. But the problem, the situation still remains, the emergency, the crisis. Lisa, thanks for the time. Good luck and be well.
Thanks. You too, Scott.
Just when you thought you'd kind of heard enough, and speaking about the extreme world of politics that we now live in, and it doesn't matter if it's here, if it's south of the border, you can't point fingers or you'll burst into flames. Former President Donald Trump is urging his supporters, or using them, to buy a God Bless the USA Bible for $59.99. Because his legal bills are mounting up, make America pray again is the slogan. Honestly, it's not a Saturday Night Live sketch, at least yet. It's still early. We'll see by the weekend. Let's bring in Brian J. Karam, journalist, author, White House correspondent for Playboy, political analyst for CNN here now. Brian, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much. Now, does this surprise you, or is this par for the course? Because even I thought, wow, I thought this was comedy here.
Well, of course it's. I mean, I hear for an extra $5, they'll even guarantee you can get an autograph by the author. Quotes have changed. You know, Proverbs says, "Oppressing the poor in order to enrich oneself," and giving to the rich will only lead to loss. It now says oppressing the poor in order to enrich oneself and giving to the rich will only lead to profit. So what can I tell you? It's Donald Trump.
So it has been edited?
No, I'm joking there.
Oh, you had me, man. I'm almost believing you here. So, but like, what about the beginning, the end, the preface? Is there any sort of vote for me, or, you know, tear this off and send it in with your check for $10, whatever?
It's a $59.99, and apparently there is a. I've heard, I don't have a copy of it, obviously, but those who have ordered it say it comes with a copy of the Declaration of Independence, the words to God Bless America, or Greenwood's song, and Donald Trump will autograph it himself for an extra $5. That part is all true. It's just a grift. What the real, if you want to get serious about it, what it could be seen is if churches decide to buy them in large numbers, it could avoid some of the problems that he would have getting churches to donate to his political campaign. You know, you can't do that if you're a religious organization. You can't donate or finance elections. But if you bought his, you know, I guess if you buy his tennis shoes, his cologne, or his Bible, that's, you know, not the same as donating to it is, but it's kind of like money laundering. And that would be par for the course for Donald Trump.
Is it working?
Who knows? You can't believe anything Donald Trump says. He, you know, the shoes he promised, those gold sneakers he promised by July, he only brought out one of them. Early reports are that, look at it this way, Scott. If you're buying his Bible, he has to sell more than 416,000 of them just to make as much money as President Biden made in a campaign stop last night in New York with Obama and Bill Clinton, $25 million. So Donald Trump is already behind the eight ball, and you can tell that he's behind the eight ball. I spent some time out in the field recently going to the swing states in the United States where, you know, your money is used to build an infrastructure of volunteers and others to go out, canvas neighborhoods, get people to the polls and make sure they vote and get your message out. And in those swing states, the only infrastructure to Donald Trump's reelection bid are those who support Donald Trump. And that's not a lot. And what you have are the Democrats. Biden has built a regular and a large infrastructure of young volunteers. They're printing, they have offices open, they're canvassing voters, they're putting out signs, they're putting together mailers. And that money is, it, you know, in normal times, and one would think this is, we'd like to get back to normal, it helps fuel the campaign. So what Donald Trump is trying to do, you know, is to fuel his campaign and pay his legal bills by selling Bibles. And if that doesn't sound like something out of a paper moon or, you know, oh, brother, where art thou? That's, I don't know what to tell you.
Obviously, you can see how this may appeal or will appeal to a segment of his base, but will it offend more than it appeals? I mean, it just, like, at what point? Okay, you know, the T-shirts, the whatever, that's one thing, but it's a Bible. Is that crossing the line? Will that offend more than it brings in?
What line hasn't Donald Trump crossed?
I know. As I'm asking these questions to you, Brian, I'm realizing how ridiculous they all are.
These are softballs you're lobbing. I've just got to tell you. Sure, it crosses a line. But this moron has been crossing lines since he, you know, walked down the escalators and decided to run for office the first time. If this is Donald Trump. And yes, it's offensive. I mean, and there are clearly people who take their religion seriously who are offended by this. If you took a look at the video that Trump put out when he started selling the Bibles, he's even kind of smirking as he says, you know, this is my favorite book. Hell, he's never even read the book. Let's be honest. You know, I doubt that he's read one book his entire life. His own mother and father said he was practically illiterate. His teachers in school said he never finished a book. Donald Trump doesn't care about books. He cares about grifting. And, you know, grifting people with the Bible is an old story. And Donald Trump likes old stories. Yeah.
There you go. And as you said, this is Donald Trump, enough said. All right. So update us now on his legal woes. We know that his bond was reduced. Does that have a significant impact? Where is all this standing now?
Well, he's still broke, so I don't care how much they've reduced it down to 100 and some odd million, which may make it possible for him to get a bond. But he's facing a jury selection in the first trial, the first serious criminal trial that he has to face in Manhattan. And that jury selection starts in mid-April on of all things, tax day. So the humor in that I can't even approach. But so they'll start on April 15th trying to seat a jury, which may take a week or two. And then he'll probably be 2 or 3 weeks into that trial. I think if you're going to assess this logically and even-handedly and factually, Donald Trump, this is the weakest of the cases against him, not the facts themselves. The facts themselves show that he paid off Stormy Daniels and he did it illegally. The trick for the prosecution is going to be getting it to the status of a felony instead of a misdemeanor, which is what it usually is in the state of New York. So I could foresee him coming away with a misdemeanor conviction and screaming how he's been screwed, blued, and tattooed, but he also vindicated. He'll scream victim as much as he can. Then the other three have been delayed. I think the one most likely to go to trial may be the trial for January 6th, and that is one of the most condemning ones. The one in the classified documents Mar-a-Lago, Florida, may never go to trial because of the incompetency of the judge there, Eileen Cannon. And then the one in Georgia, one that really frightens Donald Trump, is the Georgia trial, because if he is reelected, he can't do anything about that. So he's desperately trying to unseat the prosecution there. He's been unsuccessful so far, and he probably will continue to be unsuccessful. But as delays go, he's pretty good at delaying the inevitable, and he'll try to put it off forever until he either drops dead or is reelected.
I can't believe he didn't send you a promo copy of the Bible. Brian J. Karim with us,
wouldn't it?
yeah, and I'll pay the extra $5 to get it autographed. There you go, Brian J. Karim, journalist, author, White House correspondent, Playboy analyst for CNN. Brian, as always, thanks for the time. Have a great weekend.
You too, my friend. Have fun.
We certainly know the debate that was going on between a parking lot in Stony Creek and a housing complex. Hamilton Mayor Andrea Horvath has used her strong mayor's powers to veto a decision and reject the construction of 67 or to reject the construction of 67 affordable housing units atop of a parking area in downtown Stony Creek. Residents and businesses argue it's critical for the local economy. What's the fallout? Is there a compromise? Where does this go? Let's bring in Jeff Beattie, councillor, Ward 10, Lower Stony Creek, and with us now. Jeff, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Doing well, Scott. Always a pleasure to be with you, sir.
So your thoughts on this decision that has been made?
Well, I mean, I think we're all still recovering from the decision of the mayor yesterday to exercise her veto power. There's a lot of shock in Stony Creek right now that this took place. I think we, as the Stony Creek councillors and those who were in favor of retaining this important infrastructure in downtown Stony Creek, we went through the proper process. We went through the democratic process and only to have that overturned. It's pretty unbelievable.
Let's focus more on the decision. We remember the mayor spoke out against strong mayor's powers. Are you surprised she used them here? Her justification here, of course, the need for more housing.
Yeah, I think we're all surprised, Scott. I mean, the mayor, when she was running for office, has several quotes on record as her opinions on this. Not being favorable. She was reticent to use them when granted them at the beginning of, I think it was in 2023, the summer of 2023, where she was granted the powers. So she's been consistently moving in one direction, and then to choose this particular opportunity to make this change in her own direction, I think it's pretty surprising. I don't know that any of us saw this coming on this particular issue.
Is there not some sort of compromise here, Jeff, where you can do both or keep both sides happy, accommodate both, all of that? Is there any way, is there a compromise?
I think there could have been, but the problem is, Scott, that we never got the opportunity to get there. I mean, the first step was to basically say that, you know, the people of Stoney Creek, they need this particular piece of infrastructure maintained. As you said in your intro there, it supports a number of things in our downtown, which is in a constant state of fragility, trying to rebuild itself and reinvent itself in several ways. And the parking lots have always played a foundational piece in that. And I think that we could have gone different directions. I've certainly spoken with members of the community that would love to see other options explored. We all recognize the need for affordable housing in Stoney Creek. We could have gone down that road. And I guess moving forward, I still plan on doing that in some way, shape, or form. But gosh, I mean, we weren't even given the chance to get there because the mayor just came in and did what she was going to do.
I still have a hard time even imagining how we got here. We all know the need to build more houses. That being said, houses will also, or homes will also bring people to the area, which will actually benefit the businesses and grow the downtown. Is there not an argument there that, you know, again, in the need to, and again, I'm on both sides. I think we can do both here. I really do believe we can do both here. But can you not see the advantage of having housing there and how that will help the downtown?
I think that there's already a number of proposals. And again, I don't represent that specific part of Stoney Creek. That's Ward 5. It's Councillor Francis that represents specific. So I don't want to speak too far out of turn. But it's my understanding that there are development proposals in the area already on the books that are going to take place. They are going to bring new residents to the area, which is great. We all support that. And if we were asking the same question about the parking lot usage in 10 or 20 years, we may have a different story. We may have a different position. But in the current configuration and the way that those lots are used, or it's not really a multiple lots, just one lot with multiple pieces, it forms a function right now. It's well utilized, and because there's really no alternative, it was about maintaining that for the existing and future residents that are coming to the area, and that was really the focus. So I mean, I understand both sides of the argument, but it was really about the need for that infrastructure and what it's currently supporting.
What happens now, Jeff? We don't have much time left, but what can you tell us moving forward?
Well, I mean, from my perspective, Scott, I've already been chatting with my Stoney Creek colleagues, and I think we're steadfast in our resolve that we recognize that there needs to be a made in Stoney Creek approach to this moving forward. We don't want to have another opportunity for someone to impose a solution on our community. We want to have something come from within. And I'm committed to working with my colleagues in Ward 5 and Ward 9, Councillors Clark and Councillors Francis, and trying to come up with a made in Stoney Creek approach that will include the community, will include nonprofit providers, will include possibly private development opportunities as well. But it has to be formulated from within the community and serve the existing community.
Jeff Beatty with his councillor, Ward 10, Stoney Creek, talking about the debate between parking and housing and where it is after strong mayor's powers being used. Jeff, thanks for the time and insight. Good luck.
Thank you so much, Scott.
If Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer,
he'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk,
900 CHML.
We've talked at length about the housing situation, not only here, but everywhere. And many people are looking for ideas as we try to turn this ship around, per se. Indwell, a 50-year-old Hamilton-based charity and a housing developer, is launching four new projects that will create 140 units of supportive and affordable housing in Hamilton. They're rallying investments from everyday residents and organizations in Hamilton to raise $5 million in community bonds to fund this project. What are community bonds? How does all of this work? Nicholas Vanderveld is with us, financial manager Indwell, and here now. Nicholas, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
I am very well. Happy Thursday. Thanks for having me.
And back at you. We're always looking for solutions here, Nicholas, obviously. Tell us about this project. How does it work?
Yeah, very exciting to be here and to talk about the Hope in Homes Hamilton Community Bond. So as you said, we're INBOL. We are an affordable, supportive housing developer and operator. We have about 1,200 units in South and Southwestern Ontario. One of the components that we are challenged by is what we would require first in capital. We would call first in capital. So capital to buy sites or to actually move them through the approvals and design processes. And for that, we're launching the Hope in Homes Hamilton Community Bond. So we're looking to raise $5 million to acquire sites or to actually push them through the approvals process, getting these projects situated for long-term financing from the federal government and bring more units of supportive housing into the ecosystem.
First of all, you're a developer, and you know what happens in Ontario or Canada, developers, that's a bad word almost. You've got a different approach here. Explain to people how this is different.
It's different in a variety of ways. So what it means to be a supportive housing developer and operator is quite simple. On the one hand, we offer deeply affordable units to the folks that we provide housing to. So our rents are around the $600 a month level, whether you're in Mississauga or in St. Thomas. And then we have properties in Mississauga, Hamilton, Woodstock, Simcoe, London, and in St. Thomas. And on the other hand, we provide a spectrum of supports. So on the one hand, supports may look like recreational supports, building life skills. And on the other hand, in the spectrum, contingent on what tenants need, we provide supports such as administering medication or providing daily meals. We honestly think that there are many solutions to chronic homelessness. Supportive housing is one of the best solutions to that problem that is so apparent in all the communities that we call home, that are home to us. And supportive housing really allows you to seek health, wellness, and belonging, rebuild identity, rebuild health, and to do that with the supports that are appropriate for what you need.
As you're describing this, Nicholas, it almost sounds like a model similar to a long-term care, except specifically geared to this category, this customer. Is that what this is?
I'm not intimately familiar with the long-term care home. What I know about INBOL is that for folks seeking health, wellness, and belonging, we really have an ability to stand in relationship with our tenants, really understanding where they're at, what kind of supports they need. And if you look at our retention rates, after the first year, 92% of tenants that come to us from hospital, from sleeping rough, from sleeping in their car, from couch surfing, end up staying at INBOL. So I think that's a remarkable retention percentage. It really speaks to the quality that we offer in terms of the supportive housing that we provide, but also you know, how we stand in relationship with the folks that we provide housing to.
So obviously it's not just a place to stay.
100%, 100%. We really want to build community for folks. And so it looks like various ways for various tenants, but really digging into, like, how do we rebuild identity? How do we reaffirm the dignity that people have and how do we meet them for the needs that they have?
So it sounds like an exciting development. It sounds like an exciting way forward. How does this get financed?
Yeah, it's a great question. So we have three projects that we're looking to push forward. Acorn Flats, which will be our first family dedicated site. We have Ottawa Street Apartments, which will be geared to folks that have an Indigenous heritage. And then we also have Stonehouse Apartments, which is a church on 120 Wentworth Street that we're converting to 50 studio apartments. So these are the three projects that we're looking to push forward. What's exciting about this, Scott, is that the Hope in Homes Hamilton Community Bond is really an opportunity for folks to come in and be part of a solution. I myself came to Canada about 10 years ago from the Netherlands. I immigrated. I'm so deeply privileged to be on this land. And 10 years ago, the community that I call home looked very different from a visible homelessness perspective. And I think that many folks, myself included, I look at it and go, how can I be part of a solution? And I think that many folks ask themselves that question, but aren't quite sure where to start. The Hope and Homes Hamilton Community Bond is that place to start. So you don't have to be an accredited investor. It could be an everyday, everyday human being that is just looking to put dollars into social impact. We can start at $1,000. We provide five different terms. So interest rates from 3.5% to 5%. And then, as you said earlier, we're looking to raise $5 million in total. We have about 27 investors right now. We have about $500,000 sold. We launched last Friday, which is really exciting. Lots of progress that's made there. And so I really want to encourage folks that are seeking a financial return, but are also looking to align themselves with social impact, to take a look at the hopeandhomes.ca website and to learn more about INWO, what we do as an organization, the impact we have created over the last 50 years, and then how the Hope and Homes Hamilton Community Bond is a wonderful tool to align financial interest and a return, align social impact to provide more housing into the Hamilton ecosystem.
There you go. Thinking outside the box and exploring new opportunities. Nicholas Vanderveld with us, financial manager, Indwell. And this company is building looking to create 140 units, supportive housing, affordable housing in the Hamilton area. But it's more than just housing. Fascinating idea, Nicholas. Good luck.
Thank you so much, Scott.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
By now, I'm sure everybody has seen that incredible footage of the ship, the container ship, losing power and then taking out that bridge in Baltimore. Now, massive barges carrying cranes are on their way to that site to remove the wreckage of the Francis Scott Key Bridge. It's blocking a major shipping route. Officials say all the twisted metal concrete needs to be removed before they can open it and search for four still missing workers. Two bodies found in a pickup truck yesterday. The Hamilton port, obviously Hamilton, a port city, sees a steady stream of ships. And while our situation obviously quite different from Baltimore's, it'll be interesting to get the thoughts of Larissa Fenn, Vice President of Corporate Affairs, Hamilton Oshawa Port Authority, and here now. Larissa, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here with you today.
Larissa. I know you can't comment a lot on this individual situation in Baltimore, but as someone who is in this business, what were your thoughts when you saw that horrific video?
Oh, my goodness. We were as shocked as everybody to see this terrible accident. And you're right. You know, we're both Baltimore and Hamilton are port cities. And so, you know, we feel a lot of kinship with that city, and our heart goes out to the residents and the workers. So, we were really shocked and saddened by that.
Are you surprised that it could happen? I mean, many are, and again, it's an accident. Things happen. It's under investigation. We don't know exactly what did happen yet. But are you surprised at just the catastrophic size of all of this?
Yes, obviously it's a shock and a surprise, because, you know, incidents like this are exceedingly rare. Mm-hmm. So to see something, you know, an incident like this happen is definitely a shock. You know, there are thousands of ports and harbors around the world, ships coming in and out of those harbors every day, and a whole industry and set of government and other officials dedicated to making sure that all of those transits are safe. So when something happens, it is a shock, absolutely.
And again, much like the airline industry, these voyages, these trips go on every day. The big question here, Larissa, happened here? I mean, I remember one time seeing, I believe it was a ship that was docked that came loose and then sort of drifted over to one side of the bay. Can that sort of thing happen here?
Every port and harbor around the world is different. I think if I was, wanted to reassure people in Hamilton, I would point out that Hamilton's harbor is much smaller than Baltimore's in terms of the kinds of traffic we have. Our approach is less complicated. And so I would, I'd hope people would be reassured by that. And also, you know, marine transportation, Great Lakes shipping especially, is far and away the safest mode of transportation per ton kilometer of cargo than, you know, than rail transportation and certainly than truck transportation. So I do think that's important.
And I understand these ships that are going through Baltimore are a lot bigger than what we see here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, absolutely. So in the Seaway, so the ships that we see in Hamilton are limited by the size of the locks that that they can transit in through the St. Lawrence Seaway. So the size is of an entirely different scale than the kinds of ships that you would see on the, you know, on the east and west coasts of North America.
Does this affect, and we know how, I remember, I believe, going to your office one time years ago, and you had up on a big board where every ship was and where everything was all over the Seaway. It was quite interesting. It was fascinating. Does this affect supply chains in any way? How does, you know, we've heard many times, remember there was a ship stuck in the Suez Canal there for a while. How does this, and having this route blocked, does it affect Canada or what you do in any way?
I think that most of the cargo, you know, and if you had Marvin Ryder speak to this as well, I think most of the cargo that that is implicated in this specific incident would be likely rerouted to other U.S. Eastern Seaboard ports. So it's unlikely that it would affect us here. But, it really does just underscore the need for resiliency of infrastructure and supply chains generally. So it's an important thing for all of us to sit up and take note at, you know, what things happen and we need to have supply chains that are flexible and resilient to that.
I remember talking with Hamilton Oshawa Port Authority before. There's still room for expansion for you. Is there plans forward to increase this, increase the size, increase the shipping lanes in any way to handle more traffic?
The Seaway has capacity to handle about 50% more or rather, it is only running at 50% of the capacity it could be handling. And so absolutely, we are always looking for opportunities to move more goods by water. It's the safest and most environmentally, it has the best environmental footprint of transportation. And so we think there is certainly opportunity to expand supply chains, but that requires investment in more infrastructure to load and unload vessels. And it requires the customs clearance capacity to bring more goods further into the system, closer to their destinations as well.
This may seem like a layperson question, but how do you make sure one's not coming in when one's going out? How do you keep that in order? A lift bridge going up, all that. It's quite fascinating to watch. We see people watching it anytime ships are going in and out. Is it literally like a traffic cop? I mean, getting one, getting out?
Yeah, it is very much so. We have a dedicated harbor master's office whose role, the folks who work in that office, their role is to know what is expected in Hamilton's harbor, to communicate very clearly with the lift bridge, for example, and to know where all of the ships are coming and going and to provide direction to vessels that are on arrival or vessels that are at anchor to make sure that everyone is safely out of one another's way, to make sure that those same directions are given to recreational users of the harbor, for example, to guarantee the efficiency of the goods that move through the port, but also the safety of everybody involved as well.
I forgot the pleasure craft going in and out of there. Holy smokes. All right, so I know you can't comment a lot on this, but many are saying, wow, why couldn't this thing stop? And we obviously saw it lose power. The lights go off and on and such. Why couldn't it just drop an anchor? We're not understanding the size, the weight, the momentum of something like this to stop. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And, you know, and that's a message we have, you know, even when we are talking about the safety of vessels interacting with pleasure craft, for example, inside of the harbor, that the momentum involved in a vessel once it is moving is really a difficult thing to stop. And so for the safety of pleasure craft, you need to make sure that you are well out of the way of the large vessels, so that you know, it's just physics. And so that was certainly at play in this case.
Larissa Fenn with us, VP of Corporate Affairs, Hamilton Oshawa Port Authority, commenting on what is happening in Baltimore and really not affecting what is happening up here in Hamilton. Larissa, thanks for the time. Much appreciated. Be well.
Thank you. You too.
It's interesting, the Prime Minister unveiling his budget day by day right up until April 16th, and he's now referring to the Conservative premiers when taking questions on the carbon tax, and as if it's a small amount. And I think there's only one Liberal premier, and that's in Newfoundland, and the rest are all Conservative, with the exception of BC and Manitoba, which are NDP. But lots concerned about the carbon tax going up again April 1st, and most premiers and federal Conservatives want the Liberals to cancel Monday's increase. Meanwhile, the Fraser Institute has released two new essays on the carbon tax, and our guest says the federal government's carbon tax plan needs to be reformed in order to mitigate its negative economic impacts. To talk about more, Ross McKintrick with us, senior fellow Fraser Institute, and here now. Ross, thanks for the time. Hope you're doing well.
I'm doing fine, thanks.
Ross, what do Canadians do here? Who do they believe? Because right now, I think half or a little bit more than half aren't sure that this is all working. We've heard that from the parliamentary budget officer. But just the other day, there was, 100 academics that signed up and said why this was a great idea. How do Canadians process this?
Well, my colleagues in economics are right to say that if you're going to reduce emissions, probably the cheapest way to do it is a carbon tax. What they didn't mention, though, was even a fairly large carbon tax isn't going to reduce emissions by very much, because we are talking about fossil fuels, you know, gasoline for your car, home heating, things like that. And people just don't have an option. They need to buy it. So, the carbon tax, even at the level it's at or even higher, it's not going to get us to the Paris Treaty. And there the problem is the government has promised way too much emission reductions on a short time scale that they have no way of achieving. It doesn't matter how much cost they load up on the public. So that's something that I think my colleagues left out of that letter that you referred to.
And is momentum changing? Are Canadians starting to understand this, or understand that where the carbon tax is going? Because if you ask most, they don't know where the money is going, or if it is, or what it's doing to bring down emissions. Do you think if they tried to explain where the money was going, this would help?
Well, I think actually the shift in momentum you're referring to was inevitable, because when the government brought in its climate policy, it's long told people this won't cost anything. In fact, it'll make you better off, and there'll be all these new industries that appear, and this is going to be a mechanism for economic growth. That was never true. And eventually, they're going to have to admit to the public that if we keep on this path, it's going to cost everyone more and more. And I just don't think they had the mandate going into this whole policy, because they weren't honest with people about how much this would cost. Now, with the carbon tax and the rebate system, you can put some of the money back into people's pockets, but you can't make up for all the indirect cost increases, the price of food, the price of everything you buy in the store that goes up because energy is more expensive. And the parliamentary budget officer has pointed that out, that even with the rebates, when you take all those secondary effects into account, people are worse off.
And again, the idea here is to change behavior. If you tax people and change their behavior, they will find better ways in order to get done what they need to do. Are people looking at this as more of a fundraiser, as a redistribution of wealth, as opposed to an actual climate plan?
Yes. And if you look at what happened in BC, that's a legitimate criticism. The BC brought its carbon tax in. Initially, it was going to be 100% revenue neutral. Everybody would get all the money back through income tax cuts. That lasted for a few years. And then the government just couldn't keep its hands off the money and started using it to fund new spending. So in the essays that you referred to, my colleague, Ken Green, said, look, you can never trust the government with something like this. We just scrap the whole thing. I'm arguing on the other side, well, if they could commit to revenue neutrality, then that would help people deal with it. Although only up to a point, even with revenue neutrality, you're still going to have it costing people.
How do we address these issues without using a carbon tax?
Well, you see, now this is a point that economists have tried to explain, that there's really no inexpensive way of achieving these big emission reductions with our current technologies. Maybe 10 or 20 years down the road, there'll be new technologies that we can't currently envision. But we've been looking for 30, 40 years for a way to reduce carbon dioxide emissions in an inexpensive way, and we haven't found it yet. So I would say we'd be better off just focusing on improving energy efficiency and moving in the right direction at a manageable pace, rather than try to sprint towards a goal and then just get everybody angry about the whole process.
Why, and I've argued this many times, that we've wasted the last 20 years trying to shut the taps off as opposed to taking it a step at a time and getting the world off of coal. Are we understanding that? Are we realizing that now as different nations bang down our door for our cleaner liquid natural gas?
And in a way that's been happening, but not necessarily because of climate policy. For instance, in the United States, when the whole fracking revolution took place and the cost of gas production went down, a lot of old coal-fired power plants were converted over to gas. It was cleaner burning, so there was less cost to the environment, but it was also just a more efficient fuel for the power plants. And they brought their coal consumption down quite a bit and actually reduced their overall emissions. But in other parts of the world, coal is still king. So China and India are aggressively building coal-fired power plants. And that's where I think there's a legitimate argument that if we developed our natural gas export capabilities, we could get them to switch off coal and use some natural gas instead. And that would obviously be good for our oil and gas sector, but it would also reduce global emissions.
Ross McKittrick, Senior Fellow, Fraser Institute, talking about the carbon tax going up, obviously, April 1st. Ross, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
My pleasure. You too.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson.
On Hamilton's News, Today's Talk
900 CHML.
Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced new measures that will help protect Canadian renters and help them break into the housing market ahead of the budget. We understand instead of announcing all the budget details on April 16th, every day they're going to launch something else. Yesterday it was about renters. Today it's about childcare. The proposed measures in renting aim to amend Canadian Mortgage Charter to allow tenants to count on-time rent payments towards a credit score. And they propose a $15 million in new funding for a provincial legal aid organization to better protect tenants against bad landlords, and a code of conduct or rules, regulations, rules of engagement for that. Let's bring in Stuart Klazinga, Acorn Hamilton, and here now. Stuart, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I am well. Yourself?
So far, so good, Stuart. Your thoughts on these measures aimed at renters yesterday. Will they help?
Well, whether or not they help, we haven't seen the bill yet, so we don't know exactly what's involved or how it's going to work. So, of course, the devil's going to be in the details there. But just going off of what the Prime Minister mentioned yesterday, like credit scores, yeah, okay, that's fine. Landlords currently can, report to the Bureau of late payment or non-payment. So there's already the chance for it to be negatively impacted. So the chance for it to be positively impacted, I guess, is good. But the problem isn't really that rent payments don't show up on credit scores. The problem is that housing is unaffordable. And the problem is that renters get zero share in the equity that their rent produces. And, I don't think continuing to rely on the market to solve these problems is the answer, because the market doesn't really care about renters. The market only cares about those who hold the capital, not those who produce it.
Go ahead.
Nope. Go ahead.
In regard to credit scores, if you weren't making rent, then that would affect your credit score. So would this not do the same thing, just in a positive measure? Obviously, if you don't hear from the credit people and the landlords regarding your rent, you've done a good job of covering yourself. Does this really have an impact?
Well, that depends to what extent a good credit score is helping people who are struggling to afford rent or even unable to find a place that they can afford. You know, building a credit score in theory is a good thing, sure, but yeah. Having a better credit score certainly won't help renters be able to afford a home in the increasing market, and it won't help renters pay more affordable rents if they move. So those problems will still exist whether you have a good credit score or not.
Bill of rights for renters. Obviously, we've heard stories, rent evictions, what have you, and tenants getting the short end of the stick. A bill of rights that I understand supports both. Is that needed, or is that already there? It's just enforcement we're looking at, or we're lacking.
Well, I mean, specifically, rights that apply to renters doesn't exist in the current landscape, but the right to housing, as recognized by the National Housing Strategy Act of 2019, is something that exists, and it is already unmet for so many Canadians. So I kind of fail to see how a renter's bill of rights will help them. How will a renter's bill of rights help the next renter who ends up homeless because of skyrocketing costs of living crisis, or people looking for a place to afford now? And another thing that was mentioned was the right to know what a unit was previously rented for.
Right.
This sounds good, and this is something that, you know, Acorn thinks is a good tool, but you know, it's more a tool to help shed more light on the issues behind the housing crisis than a tool that can be used to solve the housing crisis, because it certainly doesn't help the individual who's looking for a place to rent, because the landlord still holds all the cards. They still have all the power. Knowing what the previous tenant paid doesn't give the prospective tenant any additional ability to negotiate when the supply is so far outweighed by the demand.
What should we be focused on with obviously a lens to renters?
Building more housing and more social housing, and getting getting the commodification of housing for profit sort of out of the picture. If we remove those things from the housing market, there'll be a huge difference. And so look towards more social housing, more not-for-profit housing options. And so really, we just need to build, but we need to build the appropriate units for what people need and for what people can afford and for what people
are. Stuart, how do we provide incentive for developers to do that? Because otherwise you're talking about subsidized housing, which I'm not sure everyone agrees with. So how do we, because I remember back in the day where there were apartment buildings everywhere, and then rent control came in and they stopped building apartments and then they went to condos. So what do we need to do? And we're starting to see an uptick in the building of these because the GST has been removed. But what do we need to do to create more apartments? Is there incentive to give builders to do that as opposed to creating, you know, subsidizer or freer housing?
I mean,
government, it seems governments don't have any money for anything, including healthcare or whatever. So now we're looking at housing. So how do we get the developers? How do we make this a private public arrangement?
Yeah. So there's a difference between paying the builder to build the house and then, you know, paying someone to hold that structure while it's occupied. Certainly, we need to pay builders to build housing because no one's going to build things for free. But I don't think that that's where the issue of where the profit's going lies. The issue of where the profit is going lies with those who end up purchasing those buildings and just amassing all of the equity while returning none of it to those who are paying for it.
So some sort of arrangement where the renter gets a piece of the action. Is that what you're looking at? Is that what you're suggesting?
I mean, I think that that would be great. Certainly, the renters are the ones who are building that equity. And when you move out, maybe you should get a portion of the profits, or just abolish the for-profit model entirely and, you know, look at non-profit options for holding housing so that it's affordable. And even seeing things like apartments turned into condos where people who are already paying for that mortgage can just then own the mortgage themselves without the need for a middleman.
Stuart Klasinga with us, Acord Hamilton. Speaking of the measures Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced the other day in regard to helping renters, not sure they will. Stuart, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Thank you very much for having me on and have a great long weekend.
Budget is coming out on April 16th, and normally what they do, and Doug Ford did this, they'll drop a couple of little bonbons. Doug Ford's was the gas tax. He's going to extend the gas tax cut, and then the next day he announced the budget, and there you go. Justin Trudeau's doing something a little different. I thought it was fascinating because he made an announcement yesterday, and that was in regard to renters and a Bill of Rights and your credit score and stuff. And he said during that news conference that every day, or that he was going, this is just the first of many announcements that is going to be coming up and are coming out. And again, normally with a budget, they'll maybe leak a couple or so bonbons, but then they'll wait to, you know, till budget day. And then it's the telephone book comes down and everybody's got to read it. And then they go through this grocery list of all the things that we're doing or that the government is doing. It looks like what the Trudeau government is going to do is every single day up until April 16th, they're going to basically dominate the media cycle with another new announcement. And that seems to be the strategy moving forward, which seems like a great idea, because why blow it all in one day when you can stretch it over 16 days? But at the end of 16 days, are people's minds going to be changed, or are they just going to be even more annoyed? Let's bring in Alyssa Freeman, PR and pop culture expert. Alyssa, PR. She is here now. Alyssa, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I am. This is an interesting topic, Scott. I'm glad we're talking about it.
You know, and, you know, it's an interesting PR move because it sounds great on paper that, gee whiz, why blow it all in one day when you can stretch it out over 16 days and literally reiterate everything that you've been doing for the last little while? However, does it become trying?
You know, I wonder, because announceables are something that governments live and die upon. When there is some bad news, what do? Look for an announceable to change the channel. When there's good news, let's get all the pictures out there that we can. Let's put it on all our platforms and let's crow about it. Because sometimes, you know, governments have to use their own platforms because mainstream media doesn't cover everything they want them to cover. But when it comes to something like the budget, you know, there's a certain protocol that we as Canadians are very, very used to. And that is, there's a budget day. There's a lockup before that. Reporters are all in a room. Nobody has their cell phones. They get to read through the budget and then it's formally announced. Now, instead, we're sort of taking out all the quote unquote excitement of the budget. And there's a number of interest groups that are waiting to hear if their asks are going to make it in budget 2024. I have clients, other people who work in government relations have clients, and they're all wondering, you know, all the advocacy that's been done, is it going to come out April 16th? Now, instead, what we have is sort of this spreading out of the news cycle over the next, 16 days, mm-hmm. that there will be an announceable a day. Now, I don't think that there's going to be announceables on the weekend. There might be. But what a way to really capture the news cycle and actually own the news cycle. Because number one, it's some sort of budget announcement about something that is of interest to Canadians. So everybody's going to carry it. Mainstream media has to carry it. All the government reporters are going to have to report on it. So there's no not reporting on these type of things. And right. Obviously media and reporters have that choice, don't they? But in this case, they don't. And you sort of have to look and sit back and think, this is kind of a very, very interesting and smart move.
I think we'll see this again. That's for sure. I agree with you wholeheartedly. The Prime Minister and the Liberals have constantly said the problem isn't
them. The problem isn't their policy. The problem is you Canadians are not understanding the message, and they'll come out and say, we have not done a great job of communicating that message. So that has completely changed. We've seen that. They're in your face or on social media. They're really hammering it hard. And this is another example of that. But again, as I've asked you before, will this work? Because it's not like people are hearing really anything new or different. It's just they're assuming if they repackage it and say it louder and more often, that will have a more positive resonation with the public. Will that happen?
You know, it could, because I have to tell you that we as citizens, voting citizens of any country, seem to have very, very short memories. So this could. So if you get a bombardment of good news messages and you keep hearing the same thing over and over again, it's a gambit that is used by every political party, Scott, whether you're trying to hammer away as the opposition or you're trying to put out good news. So, you know, yes, every time you put out news, it does give fodder for the opposition to say something about it. But it's kind of hard when you have all these announceables and you're announcing injections of money or tenant bill of rights or whatever the next announcement is going to be. So it's kind of hard to go up against something that is supposed to be for Canadians. Now, you also brought up another point where it's like, you're not understanding what, you know, blaming Canadians, you don't understand what we're talking about. If there's one thing I learned in the PR world is never, ever blame your end user audience. When I was with Heart and Stroke, you know, you can blame Canadians for eating too much fat and not eating enough fiber or not exercising enough. But really, are you going to make people feel good about wanting to be heart healthy? It's the same thing when you're talking about things that should be good for the country. Don't blame Canadians. Just work your way around it. Make your message, simplify your message, and tell Canadians what's in it for them. So when you say to me, can this change and turn things around? You know what? You never know. I think the jury's out.
It sounds an awful lot like a campaign, and there's no election called. Many are calling for the opposition to release their plans. Of course, that never happens until an election is called. do you think this is it? This is that if this don't work, what's next?
You know, this is a really, really big trial balloon. You and I have seen over the years when the government puts out something, it seems sort of implausible. And then we've talked about it. And I said, you know, this is a trial balloon to get a sense of how an issue or an opinion will be perceived. So now you're going to have 16 days of this. Do I think an election would be imminent after that? I don't think so. I think that there is a long way from now until then. And I think that both parties will be doing what they need to do. And this strategy is certainly interesting. So if you can cluster your announceables like this and do it every quarter or every so often, you just might be able to own the news cycle and maybe part of your voting public consciousness.
The opposite side is that if the public has already tuned out, if the public has already tuned out, will this approach make them go, oh, God, he's on TV again for the sixth day in a row. I'm going to see what he has to say. Will that turn that around?
You know, the way we consume news, Scott, is not necessarily a number of 6 days in a row. You know, if you think of a morning program or any, even your program, people listen in increments of a time. And so they may listen for 5 minutes. They may listen for 10 minutes. They may come back an hour later. So nobody ever listens to anything from end to end. I mean, of course, I listen to your show from end to end, but that's beside the point. So, but most people consume their news in little sort of information snack bites. Mm-hmm. So if you miss one announcement, you're going to get another. And if you are someone who pays attention to it ad nauseum, yeah, you might get a little sick of it. But I think that is the minority. I think what they're hoping is to have enough announceables that capture the imagination of enough Canadians and to helpfully turn the message or turn the wheel around in their favor.
Alyssa Freeman, PR and pop culture expert. Alyssa, PR, talking about politics and the marketing of it. Alyssa, as always, thanks for the time. Be well. Have a great weekend.
And you have a great long weekend and not too much chocolate, Scott.
I'll try not to.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
That's it for us. Thanks for listening. As always, we leave it to you, the taxpaying customer, to have the last word. This one from Kim via email. Welcome to Hamilton, where it takes 4 years to rebuild a Woodland Park toilet. So
Is it any wonder there is no way in hell we can possibly build both housing and a parking lot in Stony Creek? No way! It can never be done. Keep right, except to pass.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.